full time this year, this time, because you'll see in a minute about as we move from talking about Hebrew to talking about Greek, why I spent 2 weeks on Hebrew and only 1 week on Greek. The reason for that is the New Testament books, all of the New Testament books, are recorded in Greek. All right? They were written originally in Greek. Now, Biblical Greek is a little bit different from modern Greek, obviously, because it's been 2,000 years, and English of 2,000 years ago, well, there wasn't English 2,000 years ago, but English of 1,000 years ago, even, is different than English of today. So don't think that modern Greek and Biblical Greek are the same, but it's only 2,000 years, not five. But also, the New Testament books are written in a very short, relatively speaking, space of time. The earliest book in the New Testament was written down about 60 AD, between 55 and 60 AD. All right? So, roughly 25 years after the resurrection, we begin to get things written down. The oldest book in the New Testament, the ones written down the closest to us, was somewhere between 100 and 120 AD.
The oldest.
So you're looking at about a 60 to 70 year time span in which all of these books are written. All right? As opposed to in the Old Testament, you're looking at stories that began to be told before written history up to about 500 BC. So you're looking at about a 4,000 year time span in the Old Testament, as opposed to about a 60 year time span in the New Testament. So the issues of translation are infinitely easier in the New Testament because while language changes some over 60 years, it doesn't change a lot over 60 years. And back then, it changed slower because people didn't communicate with each other as quickly. It took longer, right? Mm-hmm. So the language changes happened more slowly than it does today when, you know, new words get developed and picked up all over the world in a nanosecond because we're all connected.
And a lot of new technology and stuff like that coming
out. Yes, right, exactly.
And vocabulary.
Right, exactly. So there's a lot less time and therefore a lot less language change, therefore a lot fewer translation issues. Yeah.
Okay, so we have a period of time from 400 AD mm-hmm. until 60, about
right.
60.
Right.
Where any what word am I looking for? So God
right.
is only represented by those books of the Old Testament as
right.
we know God.
Right. Yes.
Capital G.
Yes.
Okay. So that's like 500?
Yes.
Almost 500 years.
Yes.
Wow.
And a lot of people ask, well, why aren't there any sacred scriptures? Well, part of that is the Jewish community really began to close its canon. It's about 100 AD before the Jewish community really decides this is definitely the books that are scripture. But they're moving towards that process. And so they aren't including anything written after about 400 or 500 BC in the readings of.
There must have been philosophers.
Oh, sure.
And
absolutely. But
those writings
were simply
okay.
not considered. And that makes a lot of sense if you think about it. The process of including things in reading, in spiritual reading, took a long time. So it took about 500 years for the Torah to be decided that that's the Torah, that that's the five books of the law, that's it. And then it takes about another 700 years to get the books of the prophets delineated. And it takes another 600 years to get the books of writings delineated. And in the middle of that 600 years where they're deciding what the books of writings are going to be, comes the diaspora. So while some of those books that were written between about 400 BC and about 100 AD might have been included in the Jewish canon of scripture had the people of Israel stayed in Israel. In 70 AD, the Romans destroy Jerusalem, literally, level it to the ground. And the people of Israel are sent all over the world. And that's how you end up with Jewish communities in Eastern Europe and Spain and North Africa and Ethiopia and Western Europe. And now we have a much bigger issue than what books should we think about including new books in the scriptures. We have to figure out how to be a religion without a temple. Because the religion of Israel was focused on the temple. Right? You went to the temple to offer sacrifices. How are we a faith without a temple? How are we a faith when we're in small communities all over the world? And so they turn their attention from what books might be included in scripture to, we gotta figure out how to do this. And that became much more pressing, right? In the meantime, the Christian community, which is looking, is not as interested in the things that the philosophers of religion, things that, that people had been writing about God in 200 and 300 BC. They're much more interested in what Jesus had to say and in what Paul's writing and in... But the other thing you need to remember about the first two generations of Christians is those first two generations of Christians really believe that Jesus is coming back tomorrow. And if not tomorrow, then definitely next week. Okay? Jesus is coming soon. Not as in, you know, we say, you know, we believe in, you know, we'll say, you know, Christ has died, Christ has risen, Christ will come again. We definitely believe Christ will come again, but we aren't looking for him tomorrow. And we look kind of askance at people who think he might be coming tomorrow, right? It's like, maybe not, you know. But for the first two generations of Christians, they really believe Jesus is coming tomorrow and that they will be held accountable for anyone who hasn't heard about Jesus when he comes back. So their literally existential priority is proclaiming the message of Jesus to the world. And anything that gets in the way of that, get out of the way. Right? So they don't spend a lot of time writing stuff down. Because writing is expensive and time-consuming, and not that many people can read. So they, you know, why are you spending your time writing stuff down? Spend that money on a ship to take you to, you know, Spain. And tell the people in Spain about Jesus because he's coming tomorrow. Right? And it's only at about 60 A.D., when the people who knew Jesus, who had heard Jesus firsthand, are starting to die, that the Christian church begins to say, oh, maybe we should write some of this down, because Jesus is coming tomorrow, but maybe not tomorrow. Maybe, you know, so let's get that written down, you know, kind of like what we're doing with the Holocaust stories now, right? The Holocaust survivors are starting to, we're beginning to realize that we're not going to have Holocaust survivors much longer. So there's a real push to get their stories recorded so that we have them. Similar thing happens in the around 60 to 70 AD, that first generation of people who actually heard Jesus are starting to die. So we're starting to get, we want to get their stories recorded. But also, by that point, we've now spread the faith far enough that we need to have some written records that people can read out to groups. Okay? Because it's gone, the church has gotten big enough that one person can't preach to a whole town. So, hey, look here. You can read this. You know, I can't be with you at your house church meeting, and most of the meetings are house church. I can't be with you at your house church meeting as the leader of the Christian community in this town, but here, you can read this. Right?
And how many people could read?
Not very many, probably 5 to 10%, but remember that the hosts of the house churches in those first couple of generations are largely wealthy women. And one of the things in the Greek speaking world at that time, that was a hobby for wealthy women who had enough servants that they didn't have to do a lot of work, was learning to read. So a lot of those women who were funding the house churches could also read. And so it was helpful to them because they could have, you know, they could read this story about Jesus that we could then talk about at the house church. If you want to see what a house church was like, we're going to do dinner church sometime this winter, which is as close as we're going to get to. But basically, the first couple of generations of Christian worship were a great big potluck. I think that's why potlucks are so deeply ingrained in church culture. Because what people did was, remember Sunday was a work day. So they came after work with whatever they had for dinner. And they sat around the table and talked about Jesus. And if they had a letter of Paul or one of these stories that's beginning to be written down, they read that and then they talked about it. They were taught. And then at the end of the meal, just like at the end of the Passover meal, the leader of the community blessed the bread and the wine, and they shared it. And that was church. And the other thing about that was it was great camouflage, because remember, being a Christian wasn't legal. And so, why are you all coming to Sue's house for, you know, oh, she's having a dinner party? It was perfect camouflage, because, sure, why not, you know? She's just having a dinner party. Everybody does that.
So where was the Greek-speaking world? Maybe you already talked about
that. The Greek-speaking world, basically anybody who was educated enough to be able to read could read Greek.
So in the Roman?
Basically the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
There were a few people who could read Latin and not Greek, but mostly if you could read, you could read Greek.
Uh-huh. Did they speak it also?
Reading and speaking were two different things.
Still are.
Being able to read Greek was more prevalent than being able to speak Greek. Although a lot of people spoke Greek too. But everybody spoke Latin because...
But this would be their second language, right? I mean, they had the language of their regional, their local
Greek. Greek would probably be the third, because there would be the regional dialect. Mm-hmm. And then if you're going to do business in the empire, you have to speak Latin. Mm. So... But then Greek would be the third language that you would learn. Like today, you know, you speak the language of your whatever country you're in. If you want to do business in the world today, you really need to speak English. So most people learn English and then learn Mandarin or, you know, something else. All right? Now, the other reason that we have much fewer translation issues, well, two reasons that we have much fewer translation issues with Greek than we do with Hebrew. The first is, all the people who were doing the translating read and spoke Greek, right? So when we're talking about that, the King James Version translating group, they all read Greek. certainly, and most of them spoke it, but, and also the worldview of the Greek Christians who are the Christians who are writing the Greek Bible is more similar than the worldview of the Hebrew people who are writing the Old Testament. For the first part, they share a faith, right? So we're not translating across faith lines. But also, Greek is, although this is a stronger statement than is actually true, but Greek is a Western mindset language. That's not universally true, but it's true enough for our purposes. That the worldview of how the Greeks view the world is closer to how we in the West view the world than the worldview of people speaking Hebrew, particularly ancient Hebrew. Okay, so given all of that, let me pass around here. Let's see what I've got. This is all the same. All right, so that can go this way, and this can go this way. And I'll hold on to one. Yeah, you can, but let's do this first, and then we'll talk about the Septuagint. So this, what you have in front of you is a verse you are all intimately familiar with. This is the first verse of the first chapter of the Gospel of John. All right? So Greek reads in the same direction as English, so that will, unlike Hebrew that reads the opposite direction. And all of the letters are letters. All of the letters are letters.
Like the vowels.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
So if you look, see the big one. If you look under the big one, that word is theos. Theon, actually, because it's a... That's God. All right.
Under the one.
Under the one. See the word under the big one?
Yeah. But those are Greek letters.
Those are Greek letters.
Okay. God.
That's God. So in Greek, this reads, "An archhen hologos, kai hologos and proston, theon kai theos and hologos." Now, a couple of words that you can pick out from that.
Yeah.
Theon, theos, is God. Logos is word. Kai is and. All right? So the rough translation is, in the beginning was the word, and the word was with God, and the word was God. Right? I'm sorry, and God was the word, because of the way that Greek puts word order. So, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and God was the Word. Alright? So, in the King James Version we get, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And in the Revised Standard Version we get, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. In the New Revised Standard Version, we get, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. You see what I mean about translation issues. There's much fewer. Now, this is a particularly easy passage, but you get the point. The Revised English, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The New International Version, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Contemporary English Version, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Are you getting the point?
Yes.
And then we get the Message, which is more of an interpretation than a translation. And so this reads a little bit differently. The Word was first. The Word present to God. God present to the Word. The Word was God. Now what Patterson is trying to do here with the Message is communicate concept. So what he wants to get is you to get is that the Word was first, God and the Word are together, and the Word is God. So he plays with the wording a little bit. Basically, his goal with this is, we've all heard in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, so much that we've stopped hearing it. So he wants you to hear it differently. And because he's interpreting as much as translating, he can do that.
Are they all, particularly this message, mm-hmm. canonically sound?
The message is, all of the ones above it are translations. And they're all scholarly translations. The translators all come at it with different goals. Message is different. It is a translation in that he is a Greek scholar and a Hebrew scholar, and he has gone back to the original texts and brought them forward. But he does not call his a translation. He calls it an interpretation because he's a pastor. And what he wants is for the people reading his, using his translation, his book, to hear things differently. And that's his explicit goal.
Yeah.
So we don't, the message is not approved to read in worship for that reason.
Is it evangelical? I've seen that.
No, it's not. Eugene Peterson is a Presbyterian pastor who has doctorates in both biblical languages and biblical interpretation. It's a book, and if you pick it up, it looks like a Bible.
Yeah.
But his explicit goal as a pastor is, I want my people to hear the scripture differently so that they can engage it again.
Okay.
So his goal as a translator is not the same as people doing a strictly scholarly translation. His goal is, y'all have heard this so much you stopped hearing it, hear it differently. Engage it differently.
So when did he do that?
He did the message in the 70s and 80s. He's passed away recently, but that's why I included it, because it's the only one that doesn't have, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So, but you see the difference in translating from Greek and translating from Hebrew, right? The Greek is a much easier translation to get. Also, the other piece I mentioned last week is Greek was a continually spoken language from the time of the writing to the time of the translating. There are people who have spoken Greek. So you have people for whom speaking the language is deep in their souls. There are people who speak Greek today. Yes, the Greek Orthodox worship in Greek.
Yes.
But the Hebrew stopped being a language that was spoken in the world, spoken anywhere outside of worship, like Latin became, right? Hebrew stopped becoming a language that was spoken out in the world by about 100 AD. Nobody was speaking Hebrew outside of the synagogue, outside of synagogue worship or worship in the home.
Some of that because of persecution.
A lot of that because of persecution, and partially because the people are spread out all over the world. So if I'm a Jew living in Turkey, I need to learn to speak Aramaic, because that's the language people around me are speaking, and I need to do business. And certainly at first I need to learn Latin, because I'm in the Roman Empire, and I need to do business. When am I going to use this Hebrew other than in worship? So it becomes a worship language. That's what happened with Latin, right?
Yes.
Once the Roman Empire fell, people stopped speaking Latin in the world because it does them no good. But the church continues to worship in Latin and read in Latin. And so Latin becomes a liturgical language. A language that's really used only in the church, although Latin is also used in scholarly books, but you get the point. Hebrew also becomes a liturgical language, a language used only in worship, not in the world. So it stops evolving, right? But also people stop living it quite as deeply. the language you speak on a day-to-day basis, you live deeply. So, you know, people who speak French can read medieval French. We can read medieval English. It's not easy, but we can get the sense of it because it's the language we use. And English changes faster than other languages, so it's harder for us than for the Romance languages. I've mentioned before, English chases other languages down the dark alley and mugs them for their pronouns, you know? English is one of those elastic languages. It's like, oh, you have a word. We're going to take that and make it part of our language.
So the Latin translation was also?
Well, let's talk about
that
Latin.
Early?
Yeah, the Latin translation was done early. That's the Septuagint that you're talking about. But it's back from Latin back to Greek is the Septuagint. So what happens is the Bible gets translated then from into Latin.
From Hebrew?
From Hebrew and Greek.
Uh-huh.
Into Latin because Latin is the language of the people at the time that this happens, right? So we gather the Hebrew and the Greek rather early in the Christian world. And the Hebrew gets translated into Greek really pretty early. And that gets translated into Latin because Latin is the language of the people. And as the church is spreading, we maybe don't have enough educated people to read the Greek, but they might be able to read the Latin. So we get it in Latin. But then we want it back in the Greek. So we go back, and the Latin translation is the standard, and then it goes back to the Greek. So you wanted to say something about that, though.
I was only going to say that at that particular time, and everybody was doing writing.
Yes.
Libraries were being set up all over the world. And one big one was in Alexandria, where the Septuagint, meaning 70, the 70 translators got together. They produced a Greek Old Testament. And that was the Bible that they were using in the early days of the Christian faith. They weren't looking at necessarily the Hebrew scriptures. Yeah. They were looking at the Greek Old Testament.
Yeah, the Greek translation. So we get the Old Testament translated into Greek. Both the Old and the New Testament translated into Latin and then translated back into Greek.
And the churches were using Latin?
Mostly
all
the church.
Time?
Mostly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there were so many people writing books at the time. Just think of the Dead Sea Scrolls as an example. You know, there were hundreds and hundreds of books being written, including Christian books, which never got published. And, you know, we only know about them.
Yep.
Other Gospels and other letters.
Yeah. So when we get to about 300 AD, so we're 200 years past when the books that we have in the Bible have stopped being written, the Emperor Constantine becomes a Christian. All right, 325 or so. Sorry, a little bit earlier than that. And he not only becomes a Christian, but he says, Christianity is the legal religion of the empire. Well, okay. If it's going to be the legal religion of the empire, then everybody's going to want to be a Christian. So what does it mean to be a Christian? Constantine says. And so there's a council called at Nicaea. And they come out with something you're going to say in a few minutes, or you have if you've already been to church, the Nicene Creed, which is the statement of, this is what you have to believe to be a Christian. But then the next question is, all right, so now we have churches all over the place, we have people worshiping all over the place, what, of all of these writings floating around, what are the books you can go to? What, in other words, what is the scripture? And so the same process that I mentioned that the people of Israel, the synagogue, went through to decide what books were scripture, the church now goes through. And so the church leaders, have to decide which books actually are scripture and which books aren't. So there are all kinds of books. There's the ones you know about because they're in the Bible. There's about 12 other gospels that we know about by title. So there's a gospel of Mary, there's a gospel of Paul, there's a couple of gospels of Thomas, there's a gospel of Mary Magdalene, there's a gospel of Peter. Most of these we don't know anything about other than their title. And there are tons of letters that are all over the place. And a couple of other acts. You know, we have the Acts of the Apostles in the scripture. There's a couple of other acts. There's an Acts of Paul. There's an Acts of Peter. There's an Acts of John. These books are all floating around, and different congregations read them. So some read these, and some read those, and some read some other things. So the group gets together that's going to decide which these books are. Now, this is not a slow process. This is not a fast process. It takes about 200 years. But they have a couple of criteria. Something called apostolicity. That is, how closely can this book be traced back to actual people who heard the actual Jesus? Remember that other than maybe the Gospel of John, none of these books are written by, are actually written by apostles. The Gospel of John may have been written by the Apostle John, but other than that, none of these were written by people who actually walked around with Jesus. All right? So how close can we get it back to somebody who actually knew Jesus? That was one of the criteria. The second criteria is how many churches are reading this? How many communities are finding this book helpful? So when people say the church isn't a democracy, they're wrong. This was one of the things. How many communities are reading this book and finding it helpful? Remember that it's expensive to get copies of these things. So if you've made the effort to have a copy of it and you're reading it regularly, it must mean something to you. So that's what they look at. How many of these books are, how many communities are actually reading these books and how many aren't? And how many, how close is it, how orthodox is it? How does it fit with the God that we know, the God that we have faith in? How does this book reflect what we know about God from our lived faith?
They have the Nicene Creed as right. their God right. in those decisions.
Right, yes. But also, you know, our own lived faith. Does this match the God that we know? So one example that we know about, there's a book called The Infancy Gospel of Thomas. And one of the stories in that book has stories of Jesus as a child. One of the stories in that book is Jesus is playing with his friends, and they're making clay animals. And Jesus is making a clay bird, and his bird flies away. And his friends laugh at him, because that's not what clay animals are supposed to do. You're doing it wrong. And so, like children anywhere, they pick at him, and Jesus kills them all.
Oh.
Because he's a child God and has the power of God, but not the control. And so the committee said, No. We don't think so. So that book doesn't make it into the canon of Scripture.
Well, I'm glad it didn't.
Yes, because it's not right.
But somebody actually wrote that.
Somebody actually wrote that. And it, you know, it fit with a lot of the narratives of child gods from the Greek myths. And so, what, you know, hey, our God's just like your God. You know.
Can I just ask one question? In the New Testament, why don't we begin with John then, if that was written by
That's a really good question, to which nobody really knows the answers.
Oh.
And actually, the letters are not in chronological order either.
No, they're not.
The earliest letter is 1 Thessalonians, and one of the latest letters is 2 Thessalonians, and neither of those are first or, and they're not first and last. I have to go and put my vestments on, but one last thing I want to say. As they're putting together what books belong in the Bible, there's an argument about whether the book of Revelation belongs in the scripture or not. It's one of the ones that's argued about the most. And we actually have extant a letter from one of the bishops who was involved in this process, who actually wrote, this is a rough translation, but actually wrote, we can't include this book in the scripture, because if we include this book in the scripture, sometime somewhere people will think it is actually about when Jesus comes again and the end of the world.
Oh, funny.
And not about lessons for living, and that would be dangerous. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, it's in scripture, and people actually think it's about a prediction about the end of the world and what will happen when Jesus comes again, mm-hmm. and not about reflections of how to live, and that is actually dangerous. So those early church fathers did know something. All right, I gotta go. Our next